Hello, I'm Pitt Hyde. My age is 77. It's the March March 4. that's a quick start. March 4. Today's location is the National Civil Rights Museum, Memphis, Tennessee. The name of my interviewer is Faith, and my relationship to the partners, we work together on everything at the Civil Rights Museum.
And my name is Faith Morris. I am 64. Today's date is March 4th, 2020. Location is the National Civil Rights Museum. My interview partner is Pitt Hyde. And my relationship to my partner is a colleague at the National Civil Rights Museum. He is the head of our board and his involvement with the museum from the beginning. So let's start with who you are, Pitt Hyde. Where are you from?
I'm a native Memphian. I was really third generation growing up in this city. And, you know, I grew up in a family of entrepreneurs and grew up in the food business, Malone and Hyde, which later I headed up for a number of years before I founded AutoZone, which was, you know, what really concentrated on from the late 70s until, well, it's still going on today. So
it's absolutely going on today. It's more than just going on today. Yeah.
Well, business-wise, of course, that was, you know, a highlight of my business career, starting AutoZone. And fortunately, we enjoyed great success. So that was and I love to see, you know, the development of the kind of culture and the growth and expansion for all the AutoZoners. It was great.
And so with your history in business, coming in and taking over the family business and then, you know, truly with AutoZone, with all of what's happening, what was the journey to your next move?
It was interesting. I was running AutoZone, and I got a call from my urologist telling me that I had prostate cancer, and I was 53 years old at the time. And, of course, that was a great shock because I thought of myself being in great health. And so that, you know, that really led me down a different path in the sense that, you know, after, you know, fortunately it was an early stage cancer and, you know, I was able and I had a prostatectomy and it all worked out fine. Mm-hmm. But it made me reflect on, you know, what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, and it reminds you of how tenuous life can be. So a few years after that, I decided to just retire from running the company and to focus all my time on philanthropy and family and friends. And so that's what I did. And, of course, I, looking back on all of it, I'd say it's fortuitous because, you know, I felt like it was very rewarding. And also, you know, something I learned from all my years in business, you know, I spent, you know, like 80% of my time doing all the, you know, turning the wheels and tightening the screws and dealing with all the stuff from personnel to you name it, just the day-to-day operations, you spend about 20% of your time on what really made a difference. And so I finally figured out, well, if I can structure the rest of my life where I'm spending 80% of my time on the things that really make a difference. And I found that philanthropy was a good place to accomplish that. And also, for the first time in my life, I could schedule my own day, my own week. So I found it to be quite rewarding. And, you know, the whole time I was running both Malone and Hyde and then AutoZone, we always were big supporters of the community and involved in philanthropy. But, retiring from the business gave me the opportunity to really not just support good organizations and write checks, but to actually get down in the trenches and really work to make significant change, such as, you know, we've spent the last 25 years, my wife and I, on trying to reform K through 12 education here in Memphis in the state of Tennessee.
You've been very involved in education.
Right.
In fact, next to your name is education equity in many places.
Yeah, well, it, you know, to me, it's nothing more important. I mean, it's just really a criminal to have especially poor kids assigned to a neighborhood school that has been failing for 40 years, which unfortunately was what was the case in the Memphis City Schools and really throughout the public schools in all the urban centers in America. And so, and I also was a great believer that one of the hardest things to do is to give anybody anything and have them be better for it. And so the answer to that is, how do you empower the individual to solve their own problems? And to us, the most effective way to do that is through quality education from kids from day one, starting K through 12. And if you do that, all of a sudden, even a kid from the poorest family is on a totally different life projection. And so we worked at it for 25 years, and fortunately, we've been over time, we were able to make a lot of progress. And today, Memphis and Tennessee are two of the fastest, or are the it's the fastest improving state in the country as far as education results for in K through 12. So that was most rewarding. And, you know, going in those classrooms and seeing these kids really getting a quality education, there's nothing better than that.
So all this is through the Hyde Family Foundation?
Well, yes. I mean, of course, the funding comes from the foundation. But, you know, when you try to, you know, change public policy in particular, the money is a small end of the stick. It's the sweat equity that makes the difference.
Right.
You got to get to know every bureaucrat, every politician, and, you know, work and work and work, because there's such entrenched interest protecting the status quo. It's very hard to do, but when you are able to move it, the leverage is tremendous, because you know, you've got, you know, like in the Memphis City Schools, $1.3 billion annual budget, but the productivity of that capital and the people capital was very low. And if you can change that over time, you can have tremendous leverage, which fortunately we've been able to do. But, you know, I mean, and there's so many projects that we've been involved with, which we feel like have made a difference, and it made a difference in our lives as well, like the National Civil Rights Museum. I was involved in that from, the day, the original planning for the museum, and have been on its board and chairman of its executive committee since its inception. And, of course, our original objective was to take a tragic site and to turn it into something positive for the city and for the nation, and at the same time to recognize the heroes and heroines of the movement that made the difference for all of us. So, and over time, I think, you know, we've been able to make to really accomplish that, and it's been a great unifier for our city, and I think it's been a great institution for the nation.
So where did all that come from? And we're going to talk more about the museum in a minute, but I'm from Memphis. I was born and raised here. My parents made a huge impact on me to, you know, education was really critical. They were both, you know, in the public school system, and my mother was definitely a career educator. Dad said he didn't make enough money in education, and he went on to insurance and became an executive there. But they were very clear about having the goals that I needed to, you know, try to be successful and the kind of work that I needed to do and where I needed to spend my time. And you come from a very strong family. The things that you have been involved in and have made, you know, part of your life's work, you know, where did that come from?
You know, I was fortunate in that both my grandfather, my father, well, my mother, the whole family, they were great believers in giving back to one's community. And so I grew up with a sense of, you know, obligation and responsibility to try to improve the lot of our fellow citizens here in Memphis. So, and I consider that a blessing because it's been very rewarding and it's important work. So, yeah, I just thought it was, you know, the right thing to do and the natural thing to do.
What do you feel that you're most proud of at this point? What is it that has really made your life feel like you are moving and have moved in the right direction?
It's sort of a bifurcated situation in that, you know, my business career was a huge part of my life for so many years. And, of course, there, you know, the founding of AutoZone, you know, was sort of a high point and its follow-on success. But then in the second half of my life, you know, the things I'm most proud of is major things we were able to accomplish in the philanthropic circle, like we've been talking about.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, you know, there's a whole series of them. We mentioned two, and of course, Shelby Farms Park has been a delightful thing. You know, it was really refreshing with Shelby Farms Park because we're accustomed to, you know, like when you do these public-private partnerships, it's always controversy and there's always opposition, like school reform and all that. And so the park was so much fun because everybody loved the idea of a new park, you know.
And the renovation of it is amazing.
Yeah, and, you know, our objective there was we were fortunate that because of the long history out there, the penal farm first and all that,
right.
Here we had 4,500 acres sitting in the middle of Memphis, urban center, largest urban park in America, but it had been totally neglected. And so we thought here was an opportunity to really do something transformative. And, you know, the great thing about it, it's turned out so great, and everybody loves it and embraced it. And the usage has gone through the roof.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, I get a smile on my face every time I go out there. And then, you know, with being able to connect it by bike and walking paths to the whole city, it's just been, that's been such a fun and rewarding project. And I think it's had a significant impact on the city and the sense of the city's, being a great place with great amenities
right.
for its citizens.
You know, one of the things about Shelby Farms Park that I love so much, and my grandbabies come, and that's one of the places that they always like to go because they can be free. They
yeah,
can
right,
run
yeah.
and carry on and yeah. not worry about anybody saying anything about them, you know, being too rough or being fat, running too fast.
Yeah.
Is that I don't know that when people think about Memphis that they think enough about nature and the natural aspects of the city and that we push so much of the walking and the running and the cycling and the and it all comes together in the Shelby Farms Park. It all is a culmination of all the good things that we want folks to think about with what outdoors provides.
Here, and the other thing that astounds me, you know, is being a native Memphian, I historically think of diversity as black white diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, out there, it's like the UN.
Right.
I didn't realize
right.
we had,
right.
you know, the level of diversity we do, and
right.
it's just terrific.
You are, I'm trying to think of what is going on in this city that has the most impact that you either didn't start or are a partner in, or Barbara's a part. I mean, you guys have it covered in being involved in some of the most important projects, organizations, you know, those that build schools and young people. I mean, you've made a very significant footprint in this city.
You know, that I consider, you know, one of the great fortunes of having been successful in business is being in a position to really help change our city on a scale that can really make a difference. I mean, I think that's a real privilege. And, you know, what we try to do is identify those things that will make a material difference and will help attract the knowledge workers and the people of the future to our city. And it's strange, you know, when you think of philanthropy, you would never think about the Grizzlies, the NBA.
I was going to say, because that's the next thing to talk about is what's happening with, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, it's interesting. When I decided to lead the effort to try to get a franchise for Memphis, I hadn't even been to an NBA game. Now, I've been, you know, I was a big college basketball fan. Of course, Memphis State at the time, you know, had a great team. And, but the main reason I was attracted to it is I thought it would be a great unifier for our city, and also that it would raise the profile of our city in the country.
And you were right.
And it really, I mean, there again is something that's super rewarding, because you go to that thing, and it's the most diverse crowd you'll see anywhere, from the rafters to the floor.
Age to
and
cultural
everybody,
to everything.
Everybody's
right.
having a great time, and it's just a, you know, a great plus for the city. So, you know, when we look at it, it's not just what you would typically think of as charitable things or philanthropy. It's what is that mosaic that makes for great cities, you know. And so that's a, you know, that's a good example of that.
It is. It does seem like you have been very deliberate in determining what would be great for this city. That's why there isn't really any just one bucket that you have spent your time with, that your family has not supported, or that you're through your businesses or your foundation. That there are several buckets that kind of add to this full circle of what this city needs.
Yeah. That goes back to when I said we went from passive philanthropy to active, and when we decided, you know, all right, you know, let's identify those things that really would make a difference for the city. And in most of those cases, you know, we were initiating the projects. It wasn't that we were supporting someone that had been working on something for the benefit of the city for years. And so we spent a lot of time trying to analyze and study what we thought would make the difference and what would be unique for Memphis. So it was very intentional. And, you know, some of them really worked and some of them didn't. But fortunately, the vast majority of them turned out well, because we were focused on, all right, let's think about what could really differentiate the city. And so, you know, what's unique? Well, the largest urban park in America is a unique opportunity, you know, and it was sitting there neglected. So that was... you know, one we identified. And, of course, the education reform, I mean, you know, in all cities, that's probably the most important thing you can do. And I was always really concerned over the years when I was running AutoZone that we'd have so many young people that would come in that had just graduated from high school and couldn't fill out the job application, you know. And to me, that was just criminal.
Right.
So that really haunted me. And, you know, I feel like, and of course, that's taken the longest amount of time, and it's a project that never ends, because, you know, we've made huge progress, Tennessee. We've gone from 46 to 30, but we're not happy with 30 by any means. So it's an ongoing process, but at least we're moving in the right direction.
So let's talk a little bit about your family. Barbara Hyde is very involved. She's clearly your partner in so much of what you do. A little bit about her and your kids.
Yeah. Well, Barbara, you know, she's definitely, you know, my partner in all of this. In fact, she leads on much of it. And she's the president of the foundation. And while I spend probably half of my time on the philanthropy, she spends all of her time on it. And, you know, she's a very outgoing and engaging person and very smart and really wants to make a difference for the city just like I do. So, you know, And it's unusual, you know, that a couple can spend so much time together on projects mm-hmm. as well as on the home front. But we really, you know, enjoy doing both. And she's extremely good at it and dedicated. And she spends all her time. And, of course, we have a dedicated staff that works on it all the time, too. But all of us are roll up your shirt sleeve and yeah. jump in there, you know.
That's certainly what I get, and the museum has certainly benefited from just how you do business and how you engage. Let's talk a little bit about how you did get started with the museum.
Originally, how I got started was D'Arby Bailey and A.W. Willis came to see me about their plans. They had, they had been part of the group that had bought the Lorraine Motel. It was auctioned off on the courthouse steps because it was in bankruptcy. And, of course, there were all, a lot of people in the city wanted to bulldoze the place because they saw it as a tragic site that they wanted to remove from their history. And, they came to see me about, the idea of turning it into a museum, which to me made all the sense in the world. And so that's how I originally got involved. And this is just, when they were starting to the work on putting the museum together and trying to raise the money and so forth to get it launched. And so from that day forward, I was on the board and involved, and, we were funders of the museum, as well as we raised, probably the first 10 years or so, we raised the majority of the private money for the museum. And, I always felt from the first time we talked about it that it was something that really needed to be done, and it was totally appropriate. This was, truly not just a tragic site, but a historic site. Right. And one that, we needed to use for the benefit of the citizens of Memphis and the country.
So when you think about 1991, when the museum was officially opened and what it was able to do in those early years, and then think through, from then till now, what your perceptions, what's your impression of the journey of the museum?
Well, it was a long, hard journey, especially on the front end.
Yes.
I mean, today it's much more of a pleasure because it's so recognized and we have so many visitors and we're in such great financial shape, And there, in the early days, it was very up and down, and there were a lot of different opinions of what the role of the museum should be, and there was a lot of back and forth at board meetings.
Today, we still hear it every day about the role of what
yeah,
the
but
museum,
it's not it wasn't as combative as it was back then, So it was challenging, but again, all along I knew that this was a mission that was important, and that no matter how rocky it might get at times, that we had to stay the course and build this institution into what it's become today. And, we had our rough times. There were a couple of years where I picked up most of the payroll, as a matter of fact. But, today,
I think your staff wrote most of the Freedom Award when I got here. It's clear that your staff, Teresa always, was so involved in writing, everything and the speeches and the scripts. And
yeah, we were almost like part of the staff
for many years.
But today I'm delighted that, we have such a great team and you guys can, carry the ball on your own very effectively, which is great. But we just sort of pinch-hitted, whenever we were needed, we'd show up to help us get where we needed to be.
So now with us being, we talk about it being the power of place, to position the museum from not only being a historic institution, which is absolutely critical, the place where history happened,
right,
know, but to also be able to make folks understand the magic that happens, you know, on this campus, the significance of what happens on the campus,
right,
starting as an assassination site for Dr. King. But I guess being able to combine some of how it started, or the intent for how it was started, as a place where people could come and really understand what's in the movement and talk about their own experiences and, you know, bring people in, mm-hmm, from all over the world, actually, so that this community and, you know, most of who come to go through the museum are actually from, you know, outside this country and certainly at least 330 miles from Memphis, Tennessee.
Certainly.
More than 70% of them are coming from a long way to, mm-hmm, spend some time here.
Mm-hmm.
But to be able to have folks come on a regular basis through our programming, you know, so they can exchange with each other, you know, mm-hmm, what's happening in this movement and, mm-hmm, make the parallels from every exhibit that we have in the museum that has a contemporary parallel now for almost everything that we, mm-hmm, talk about there.
Well, I think it really serves a whole range of purposes. I mean, from a historical perspective, obviously, I think, particularly for young people that don't really recognize what their forefathers had to endure and what they had to, you know, struggle with to finally get us to the point we are now. And yes, we have our problems today, but I remember Ben Hooks and Maxine used to always tell these young people, well, yeah, we got problems today, but you ought to be thankful for the progress that we have made, you know? And I think the other big role that we play is a reminder that ordinary people can do extraordinary things.
Absolutely.
If they have the courage and the conviction that they want to make a difference. And, of course, the whole, you know, idea of the Freedom Awards was to recognize those people that are championing the cause of freedom and individual rights here and around the world today, and point out and recognize those people that, you know, a lot needs to be done. And fortunately, there are a lot of really good, great champions out there,
right,
working on trying to better the plight of man in all over the world. So, yeah, I think it has a real purpose on many fronts.
With the Freedom Award, and it has been around since the museum opened almost. It's been around since.
Well, we started it about, I guess, a year or two after we got going. And, in fact, we were the first sponsors of the Freedom Award. And of course, the whole concept was just what we got through talking about. And, of course, it's been a great success. And some of the most amazing moments I've ever had have been, we used to, Ben Hooks and Billy Cowles and I used to take the recipients on a tour of the museum. And, of course, being with... of course, Billy Cowles, as you know, but for the audience doesn't know that he was standing next to King when King was assassinated. And, of course, he dedicated his life to telling the story, mm-hmm, of as the witness, basically. And
your daughter was involved in that. You didn't mention that little thing, and that's a very interesting story.
Yeah. And so... we would take, these leaders through the museum. And, of course, with them, they knew everybody's pictured on the wall and every event. So all of it came to life. And I never forget when we were taking Nelson Mandela through the museum. And, of course, the tour ends up at King's room, and we take him out on the balcony where King stood. And as we walked out there, Nelson Mandela, he raises his hands and says, We must pause. This is truly a holy place. I can feel the presence of Dr. King. Mm-hmm. And I mean, oh.
Yeah.
I mean, those kind of moments you never forget, you know. So, yeah, it's very special.
What is it that you would love to see as part of our future, the museum's future, and actually the future of the city, too? But start with the museum. What is it that you would love to see?
I think the role of the museum, a lot of the things we should do that we're doing now, we should continue. I think we should... Hopefully, we will take more of a role as a convener to help solve current problems and opportunities. We don't solve them, but by bringing the various parties together and help them work through a solution.
Right.
Sort of like in the way Martin Luther King approached problems is it's not about... We're not adversaries. We're here for the betterment of all man is what you're really here for. And so I could see us and hopefully see us playing a bigger role in that respect.
You know, one of the things with MLK 50, and the museum is always busy, as you know, and our partnerships run deep and, you know, such good relationships with scholars and clergy and teachers and young people. We've got so many young advocates that are involved, and certainly corporate leaders, civic leaders, very involved with legislators. We're apolitical, but we absolutely know about policy and policy making and those that are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that happened with MLK 50 that I think brought it kind of all together is how much of a partnership we had with so many different entities. And they were all over the country, all over the world, creating their own way of where do we go from here. And a number of them are still active. Many of them got started during and because of MLK 50. And I think that's one of the proudest moments that we have that was a result of MLK 50. You know, MLK 50 was all-consuming. We were absolutely exhausted by the time April 4th, 2018 mm-hmm. came around. And because it was such a big push and so many people were involved and it had impacted so many, we continued it through the end of the year because they really, really wanted to stay engaged. But it is a proud moment for the museum and for us that were so close to it that many of those initiatives are still happening now. And they're looking for, you know, the next wave of how they can continue that work. So that's a good thing, a very good thing that happened with it.
No doubt.
What about Memphis?
I believe Memphis is really... got great momentum going today.
Really does.
I mean, we've made huge progress. A lot of people have worked hard to get the city moving in the right direction, both economically, socially, and otherwise. And, I'm feeling proud of the progress that's been made. And again, you know, we got a lot of work in front of us, but at least, you know, we've had good momentum. And the thing I like is, you know, when you take surveys today, the people that are the most enthusiastic about Memphis, I'm talking about Memphians, is the younger generation,
right,
which is really, that's your future. And, of course, while all citizens have attitudes and outlooks for the city have gone up tremendously, the most enthusiastic people about the city and its where it's going and its outlook is the younger generation. So I think that's the best endorsement of the work that all of us have been doing to try to improve our city in every respect.
I do think that Memphis, you know, being a native Memphian and then going away for 25 years and then coming back for the museum, it's interesting to see, you know, the differences even while I was gone and when I came back. that it does feel like there is something very different going on in the city. It feels like there is more of an agreement to make this the city that we want it to be. And there's a 901 something across every board you can imagine. And I love it. I love it. To see the work that's happening downtown, to see the focus on the communities. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that I never remember there being trying to be have as much of an equal focus across the communities. It was always East Memphis or downtown, and right. everything in between was whatever, right?
Yeah.
So it does feel good. It feels like that we have decided to make Memphis a priority.
Well, you're a great example of that. You have that perspective of having grown up here. And of course, that 25 years you were gone is when so many of the building blocks were laid.
Right.
And
yeah.
so all of it has sort of come together at this time. In the last several years, you know, it's come together and we got a new level of momentum that's exciting for everyone.
Yeah. Well, it shows. And your involvement in so much of it really does show. So I'm going to personally thank you for
that. Oh, well, listen, Barbara and I, like I was saying earlier, we feel like it's a real privilege to be in a position to try to help our city in any way we can.
I think that's it. I think we've covered it all.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
I enjoyed it.